Good morning.
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 We are pleased to welcome today Toshu as our guest speaker. Toshu has a long affiliation with this center as a disciple of its founder, Tozen Akiyama. He's been away for 11 years? 12 years? Yes. So this weekend we have the opportunity to become acquainted or reacquainted with Toshu. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I'm going to get out of the way and let you introduce yourself maybe a little bit and share your Dharma thoughts for this morning.
Thank you. Thank you for your welcome, and you've been very kind all weekend. I've been very well taken care of, I have to say. So today, first I'll tell you what I've been doing for the last decade. I went off to work in Redmond, Washington, and I started a little practice group there. Actually, the person who some of you probably don't remember, Audrey Carabinas, who came through Milwaukee briefly, but she's the person who suggested that I come up and meet with Tozen. It was a very happy suggestion. And she wound up in Seattle, and I was offered a job. And so there was a group, small group of about half a dozen people with which I was practicing there. And occasionally I would come back to Chicago and also visit the group in West Lafayette that I started visiting while I was in training here. Then things changed, you know. Life happens while you have your own plans. And I wound up having to move from Seattle to D.C., where things have been interesting. But enough of that. We can chat about how interesting Washington politics are at another time. That's not really germane today. Dogen says his teacher told him to stay away from princes and kings and that sort of thing, and he was right on. I think I'd like to tell you, by way of a little bit of a more specific introduction, what I do for Dharma talks and lessons, and they're very different, and you know, it might at least give you an appreciation of what the defects are of the talk that I'm going to be giving. For a lesson, I do something that's very detailed. I do a very, very detailed outline, sometimes write out whole blocks of text, and this is something that can get readily translated into an article or something that's written. It's very close to that. For a Dharma talk, is more jazz for me. It's more improvisatory. So I have a page of notes, and I have some other text that I'm going to play with, and I'm going to just sort of freewheel my way through it. That's how I do things. So with that out of the way, I'll begin the talk proper. Reality really has no biases. It doesn't care much about samenesses or distinctions or how we want to slice up the universe into different categories. It equally supports all the ways you want to pick things apart. And we love doing that because it allows us to tell stories and create narratives and analyze problems and solve them and do all those wonderful things that humans do and which are important to civilization. But that's our doing. That's what we impose on. That's what we do with this mélange that we're presented with. We find categories, and they're useful or they're not. So we keep them, or hopefully we discard them. Sometimes we keep categories that have outlived their usefulness a bit too long. So that's sort of a background. I'm going to be talking about sort of the interplay of two opposite themes in practice. And specifically, I thought, since this is really where I learned how to practice Zazen correctly, I'd like to talk about how it applies to practicing Zazen. So we have these different practice forms, these different ways of sitting on a cushion and meditating. And we tend to divide them up in cultural chunks or school chunks or religious chunks. And the universe supports that because, you know, it allows us to make whatever distinctions we want to make. But there are also similarities and grand continuities that I think we can lose sight of if we get over attached to how we divide things. So some of the differences that we observe is, for instance, how do you go about explaining a practice? How do you go about teaching it? Culturally, there are differences between what goes on in the Indian tradition that we can read about and what goes on in China and Japan. In India, everything tends to be very rational, laid out, and prescriptive. There's a recipe that you follow, and this is it. The way to teach in China and Japan tends to be more poetic, less rational, and more provocative in a way. And I'm going to be talking about one of the ways of discussing practice from this poetic point of view. So, going back to the grand continuity of it all, let's consider how the Buddha viewed meditation. What did he think was different and unique about what he was doing versus what he was exposed to in India? And the key thing, I think, is that we find in the old text is that the Buddha said that the folks that he was practicing with before he went off and discovered Zazen is that the practice in India of meditation was centered around tranquility. Really deep tranquility. Just concentrating so fully on something that there was no disturbance. Everything was smooth and even and quiet. And that's reflected in, you know, the Chinese view of tranquility by itself is 1,000 miles of earth and not a single blade of grass. Often a blade of grass, a piece of vegetation that's peeking up above the ground is how in the Chinese tradition thoughts are treated. So you have this total tranquility. Not even a blade of grass. But the Buddha valued insight as well. And he thought that the practice of completely suppressing thoughts, which you can do if you follow a recipe rigorously, was not, it wasn't solving his problem for him. It wasn't giving him any insight into the nature of suffering or what to do with it. So he emphasized insight as well. So in the Indian traditions, if you look in the Theravada school meditation manuals, you have a catalog of 38 or 40 different methods of meditation. And they're all neatly categorized and specified as to how much insight each one contains, if any. And that has implications for how you can practice, too, which are irrelevant. We can talk about that another day, maybe. But the Buddha was valuing insight as the key thing to introduce into your practice so that you can understand the Four Noble Truths and actually do something with the suffering that we experience. So we have also in much closer to home, Sawaki Roshi's teaching and Uchiyama Roshi's teaching, where they have the ideal of Zazen is this perfect line from A to B. And there's no deviation, and that's the ideal. But actually what happens is we deviate from that. We get kind of drowsy and we fall asleep and we become very tranquil and if we're lucky our head does not hit the wall. Or we can become agitated and caught up in thoughts and storytelling. And these actually express the same kind of balance, only in a more perhaps negative way. On the one hand, you have tranquility or drowsiness. And on the other hand, you have distraction or insight. And whether you call these deviations one or the other kind of depends upon, again, how you're slicing up the universe, how you're dividing it. So, in Dogen, there are a lot of passages where he has these images in which he combines a static and a dynamic component into one image. And I'd like to suggest that these passages in Dogen, which seem to be radically poetic and have nothing to do with anything, are actually very specific and have a lot to do with practicing Zazen. And so what I'd like to do for the remainder, having sort of laid out what the agenda is, I'd like to talk about a few passages in which this happens. Dogen's teacher and he, and Dogen himself, both wrote two poems, Zazen Shin, is their title. It's Zazen is Zazen, and Shin is actual an acupuncturist's needle, a probe. And so the title is the titles of these poems are sometimes rendered as the point of Zazen. Not that there is any point, but the point in general. So I'm not going to do the whole of Dogen's Zazen Shin. I'm only going to refer to the last verse. The water is clean, right down to the ground. Fishes are swimming like fishes. So there's an image in which he presents this tranquility aspect of sitting and also the active insight, the fact that there's stuff happening still. There's not a complete suppression. And then the last two lines of the poem, the sky is wide, clear through to the heavens, and birds are flying like birds. And here again, the active side is the insight side or the thought that bubbles up and is immediately let go. So that's a short example. And I think that if you look through a lot of Dogen's writings, a lot of his poetry really can be, I hate to say made sense of, because it always makes sense even if you don't understand it. But it's an expression of what practice is like and how one goes through it. I think I have time to go and also talk at some length about a favorite, but regarded by most scholars as obscure, inconsequential, and unimportant chapter of Shogo Genzo. But I like it. And it has condensed in a very few pages. So I think I would have time probably to read it all, if not talk about it all. A lot of these images piled one upon the other that express conflicting or harmonious opposites. The chapter, I'm going to be using Cleary's translation, and he translates the fascicle as the dragon howl. And it starts off in the first case. A monk asks Tosu, is there a dragon howl in a dead tree? And here we have a dead tree, obviously tranquil, and then we have a dragon howling in it. And Tosu said, I say that there's a lion's roar in a skull. And there he's just answering back with the same thing. And the lion roar is, of course, a reference to the preaching of the Buddha. So having cited that case, Dogen then goes on, talk about the dead tree and dead ashes is originally, I'm going to change Cleary slightly here, an outside teaching. Cleary uses deviant, but I think I'll use outside, non-Buddhist teaching. However, the dead tree spoken of by non-Buddhists and the dead tree spoken of by the enlightened ones are very different. Although non-Buddhists talk about the dead tree, they don't know the dead tree, much less hear the dragon howl. Non-Buddhists think that the dead tree is dead wood, and practice as if for it there is no more spring. And he's just simply adding to it, sort of expanding. This is what Dogen does. He takes a simple case, a simple understanding, and then he likes to expand on it. So he continues. The present mountain trees, ocean trees, and sky trees are dead trees. Originally, they're quiet. Everything, you know, vegetation is often a symbol of thought, activity. And here, there's a little bit of a twist on it because he's using a dead tree as the place where the dragon howls. And he's also talking about all these other living trees as also dead. And this is sort of going back to the fact that originally everything is really, really quiet. That there's really originally no disturbance at all. There's no disharmony. The present mountains, trees, ocean trees, and sky trees are dead trees, and the sprouts are the dragon howl of a dead tree. Even one with a circumference in the billions is a descendant of the dead tree. The characteristics, essence, substance, and power of the dead tree is the dead wood post spoken of by the enlightened. It is a not dead post. So, he's working in two ways here. There's the ultimate, sort of a top level, sort of grand, universal, metaphysical point of view, where ultimately everything is completely tranquil, utterly dead, even if it is alive. So he's talking about the universe as it is before we start making these categorizations, before we start splitting up things into the right, left, tranquil, insightful, sleepy, agitated. There are mountain and valley trees. There are field and hamlet trees. The mountain and valley trees are occasionally called pine and cypress. The field and hamlet trees are conventionally called human and celestial. The leaves spread based on the roots. This is called the enlightened ones. Roots and branches must return to the source. This is participative study. Being like this is the long reality body of the dead tree. It is the short reality body of the dead tree. And again, here, this reference to the reality body, the Dharmakaya, is he's talking about the interplay here between the universal and the particular. But as long as it is not a dead tree, it does not make a dragon howl. If it's a simple particular dead tree that's just totally dead, nothing's going to come of it. If it is not a dead tree, it does not lose the dragon howl. How many times meeting the spring without changing the mind is the dragon howl of total death? That's another reflection of the interplay between complete quiescence and something that's more lively. Though it is not among the notes of the musical scale, the notes of the musical scale are earlier and later, two or three children of the dragon howl. Okay? It's relatively simple. However, this monk's statement, is there a dragon howl in a dead tree, has become manifest for the first time in a question in measureless eons. It is the manifestation of a saying. It's spring for the dead tree. It's the dead tree shooting forth sprouts. Dogen goes on, Tosu's statement, I say there is a lion roar in a skull, is a case of what is hidden, is a case of restraining oneself and putting another first. It's a case of skulls littering the field. Again, quiet. So Dogen is going to conclude by talking about a number of other cases that reflect the same kind of tension between tranquility and insight. And the other cases are charming because they, well, poetically mostly, but they talk about, they really offer sort of a kind of Cliff Notes version of all the other koans that have to do with this topic, and all nicely collected in one little place. So he has the case, a monk asks Kyogen, what is the way? And Kyogen said, a dragon howl on a dead tree. The monk said, I don't understand. And Kyogen said, eyes in a skull. Again, combining the image of there being something alive, even in the midst of this quiet. Later, a monk asked Sekiso, what is a dragon howl in a dead tree? And Sekiso says, still joyful. And the monk asked, what are eyes in a skull? And Sekiso said, still conscious. So here Sekiso is definitely sort of pushing. Probably he was confronted with a monk who was having problems with clinging to excessive quiet. And so Sekiso is pushing a more active practice, suggesting that by his responses to these questions. A monk also asked Sozan, what is a dragon howl in a dead tree? And Sozan said, the bloodline is not ended. So here he's taking a more Buddhist school, Buddhist practice tradition approach to it. He's saying that's what we really are all about, is aiming our practice at balancing between quiet and activity. So the monk comes back and asks, what are the eyes in a skull? And Sozan said, not entirely dry. Now, that has a couple of other, let's expand on that a little bit, because there's a meditation technique in India that is called dry insight, where you really, really play a lot with the mental processes. You don't aim at any sort of quiet at all. You just really sort of ride the turbulent sea of whatever waves the mind wants to throw up, and that's one method that's used, that was used in the Indian schools, and it's something that we don't really do in Zen. We like to have a little bit of moisture. We like to have a little bit of you didn't overdo the insight thing and make it so dry that it becomes dead. is the point. If you can go to once you go to one side or the other and you lose that balance, then you run the risk of making it a habit, a pose, a way of prefabricating the way you're going to be dealing with reality and not really being there in the moment. The nice thing about that line from one end to the other in opening the hand of thought is that it expresses the notion of a balance. You may deviate, but you come back to some sort of balance as you go. So this case with the monk and Sozan actually continues. I interrupted them. I'm sorry. The monk asks, "Does anyone hear?" And Sozan says, "There is no one in the world who does not hear." And the monk asked, "What writing does the expression dragon howl come from?" And Sozan said, "I don't know what writing the expression comes from, but those who hear it all die." So this is a case where he's emphasizing probably to someone who was perhaps over attached to insight and distraction that he needs to moisten up his quiet, you know, not pay more attention to that, allow some quiet, don't be so dry about being active. So after having dealt with all these cases that summarize Dogen's point, Dogen is going to launch on sort of a final piece of editorializing. The hearer and the howler, of which an attempt is being made here to speak, are not equal to the howler of the dragon howl. This tune is the dragon howl. In a dead tree and in a skull are not inside or outside, not self or other, they are present and past. Still joyful is, moreover, the horn on the head growing, like a unicorn. Still conscious is skin and flesh falling away entirely. And that's an echo of Dogen's body and mind falling away in Zazen. Sozan saying the bloodline is not ended is a case of speaking without avoidance. It's a case of turning around in the stream of words. Not entirely dry is the ocean drying up, but not reaching the bottom. Because not entirely dry, it is dryness upon dryness. Dryness upon dryness is a kind of dryness that can't be exhausted. So he's talking about sort of the ultimate dryness that you can never really ever really completely pacify, completely silence the activity of the mind, which is completely natural. To say does anyone hear is like saying does anyone not attain or does anyone not hear. As for there is no one in the world who does not hear, one should yet ask, leaving aside, there is no one who does not hear. When there is no world, where is the dragon howl? Speak quickly. I can't. That one's a toughie. I don't have much to say. As for what writing does the expression dragon howl come from, it should be made a question. The dragon howl is of itself making a sound, holding forth, that is in the mind. It is breathing out, that is in the nostril. As for I don't know what writing the expression comes from, there is a dragon in written expression. As for those who hear it all die, it is pitiable. Now the dragon howling of Kyogen, Setsuzo, and Sozan make clouds and water. Ah, that's monks. I do not say eyes or skull. This is 1,000 melodies, 10,000 melodies of just a dragon howl, still joyful, a clam howl, still conscious, a worm howl. Due to this, the bloodline is not ended, and gourds are heir to gourds, because not entirely dry. The pillars are pregnant, and the lamps face the lamps. And that last passage, I think, is a poetic description of that aiming at this balance in practice is really what we are called to do, and what we inevitably fail at to some extent. maintaining this balance is as difficult as running that line perfectly from A to B, and we don't have to do that. Sometimes the post is dead, sometimes the dragon howls within it, and it's okay. So, let's chat. Do you have any questions?
Maintaining balance. That's quite a task.
Yes, but it doesn't have to become too difficult or too onerous. We can we know, you know, there's a difference between the ideal and what we do. And so as long as we simply acknowledge that we have this idea of what the ideal is, we need to be able to forgive ourselves for not attaining it. And we need to accept the reality of the practice as we find it. We see these deviations happen and we play with them. We ride the waves, we experience a period when things are very, very quiet and dark and drowsy. And we need to persist through that in our practice and allow the balance to restore itself. If we return our attention to our posture, our body, our mind, our breathing, that all happens naturally. It's taken care of for us. Zazen itself is the upright posture, is the dead post. The spine itself is the dead post. And the activity of the mind that we experience, perhaps, is the howling of the dragon within the dead post. So and there's another way in which we can read that saying as simply a description of the posture of Zazen in a very poetic way. Bob?
I think an analogy may be that we vow, but we know we're not going to keep the vow. We know we can deviate. We will deviate. Mm. But we keep coming back to the vow.
Yeah.
Because that's what we have vowed to do, even though we know we're going to deviate from it.
Yeah, and life calls us to make corrections. I mean, it calls us to make, I mean, we can't just sit in our perfect posture. You know, thinking perfect thoughts. You know, we have to, you know, cook food, go to the bathroom, clean the house, and do other things. And all these situations that we find ourselves in, we're going to have to make a choice about how we respond to them. And I think the wonderful thing about our practice is that it allows us to have a little bit of a lever that allows us to make these choices more freely. When I'm confronted with a difficult situation, I can have the choice of being a dead post and just taking it all in, or I can respond in some way. And what I think is important is to try to get through things with a modicum of grace and practice is that we be free to be making the appropriate choice in that moment.
Sometimes you, as for myself, as I think I'm talking about, you think when you retire and if you're not beset with a whole bunch of things you're doing anyway, you haven't really retired, but if when you retire, you think, well, maybe I have time to sit more, study more, than to do, to really get a handle on Buddhism and try to work out a good practice. Well, whatever good practice is. But I find that I am struggling I just almost given up on drinking. You know, I want to go back to the Buddha, mm-hmm. Buddha's teachings. Because it's one day it's this, next day it's that. As far as drinking for me is, you know. Mm-hmm. The dichotomy is really driving me crazy. Mm-hmm. So I'm just saying, I know. It's difficult, you know. I've been pretty sick this last year, and I just got out of the hospital yesterday, but I took a Dogen book with me. Put it down. In fact, I put it and locked it up in the closet.
Yeah. I think, you know, we're going to eternally disagree about Dogen, and that's okay.
Yeah. I see there's this big turn towards Dogen, mm-hmm. but it doesn't offer me anywhere near the comfort I get from reading the Buddhist teachings.
Yeah.
Uchiyama, by the way.
Excuse me?
Uchiyama.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think also, you know, if you want to go back to really, really old layers of Buddhist teaching, one of the things that struck me when I was reading the Sutta Nipata, which is in the Pali Canon, mm-hmm. is how much